Access your number 16808, rule 6.
Reg Spittles, rule 6.
Yes, so we came down this track and I was driving for Fred Tilly and I completely forgot that we'd got these sand shields fitted, which naturally made the tank a bit wider. And Fred said to me afterwards, "I would love you to have seen it," he said. "The post went out the ground like a couple of matchsticks and it flew up in the air." But of course, the trouble was, there was such a thing with the lads that we had to stop the tank and go back and replant them. Back in the holes, dig the holes, and batten them down and make them firm again so everybody could have the privilege of driving through without knocking them over again, which you didn't do with a normal Valentine, but of course with the sand shields on, you were that much wider and that wouldn't go through. But just one of the funny incidents that that occurred, just to show that it wasn't all serious and dull work. But eventually, of course, time changed and they decided that we'd got to go into winter quarters again, and so we then moved down to Wiltshire and we went into a proper camp at Ogbourne St George, which was situated in between the towns of Swindon and Marlborough, and it was a proper camp, and the whole brigade was in this camp. So you had basically Brigade HQ in one area, and then the 1st Northamptonshire Yeomanry in another area, the Gloucester Hussars in between them, and the 2nd Yeomanry, who was us, at the far end of the camp. So as you rove along the road from Ogbourne St George up to Compton Bassett Airfield, you passed along the front of this brigade barracks, as they were really, because they were stone-built proper huts, each accommodating a troop of men. And of course we had barrack square, proper concrete barrack squares and everything, big naffy we'd got, a big entertainment hall, everything. It was a real camp, and I do believe it was there for many years after the war as used by training regiments and that. I know it's gone now, but it was there for many, many years after the war. It was the first time that we'd been in a camp proper, and Air RSM was Mr. Kenwood, who was a Royal Tank Regiment proper, a regular, and he used to give lectures. Now we were in a proper camp, he used to like to give lectures. He'd have sergeants, all the sergeants, and give lectures, and all the corporals he'd give lectures. By now I was a troop corporal. And so I used to go to some of his lectures, and he was they nicknamed him Black Joe, because he'd done donkey's years in the tank regiment, and he was a small little chap, and he had a peculiar walk, because he used to try to take the normal pace, which meant he used to duck his head down as he walked. He looked a bit like a duck in a way, you know. But he was Air RSM. And
so where does the black come into it?
He nicknamed Black Joe.
Why black?
Well, he'd done so many years in India that he was really black, very dark and swarthy. And he told us when he came to us, it was in 1939, when the war had just started and we were territorials, commonly called Saturday Afternoon Soldiers. And we were a local hall, Wharton Hall, and Joe, as he became known, Joe Kenwood. And when he arrived, at the same time, we had a new colonel, Prior Palmer, who came from the North Lancers. And between them, they had the job of turning us Saturday afternoon soldiers into fighting men, which we didn't give them much chance for that. We didn't think they got much of a chance, you know, that they were on a rough job. But anyway, they came to sort us out, to make us into soldiers. And I wasn't on the parade. You find that lots of stories in the services are not what you personally experience. They're what you hear, other people have heard, and the stories are passed on. And apparently Ken, as he liked to be called, to his personal friends, he was there, and he got the squadrons on parade at Wootton Hall, and being sent to as a regiment sergeant major to a cavalry regiment, which we were, yeomanry, it sort of was a bit off-putting to drill or talk to cavalrymen as compared to Royal Tank men, you see. And it's supposed to be said that when he got the command to bring a lot to attention, instead of saying to attention, he apparently said, "Get up," as though they were mounting horses. I wouldn't think it was true, but it was a good story that came. And he had this deep, guttural voice. And I used to do mimicking, and lots of times used to have fun. I used to imitate his voice, old Ken. And anyway, he came to make us into soldiers, you see. And the stories concerned him allegedly. But when he came, apparently on one of his parades, he introduced himself, you see, and he said, "I am Mr. Kenwood. I am your regimental sergeant major, and I've come from Tidworth. And if you talk to anyone in the Royal Tank Regiment and ask of RSM Kenwood, they will say, 'Oh, that black bastard,' because," he said, "I'm always referred to as Black Joe to those people out of earshot." So that was apparently his introduction to the regiment, and it stuck, you see. So we always called him Black Joe, you see. After the war, we had our regimental dinners. We were at one of these dinners, and I found myself sitting, as my wife is not keen on these sort of things. She doesn't like going to these dinners, so I usually go on my own. And on this occasion, not matching much where I sit because I'm a loner, I found myself sitting in between Ken, Black Joe as he was, and George Jelly, who was the regimental sergeant major of the 1st Northamptonshire Yeomanry. Now, George was a First World War man, and in the artillery, and he finished up as regimental sergeant major in the 1st Northamptonshire Yeomanry. And because he'd always been a line man from the First War, a territorial soldier in between the wars, and risen to the ranks, he had a sort of a ongoing animosity towards Ken, who was a regular, you see, having been a regular all his life. And so there was this little bit of ill feeling, as you might say, between these two men. More apparent in George, unfortunately, than Ken. It didn't seem to bother Ken much. But then I'm sitting there between two RSMs, ex-RSMs, because we're now civvies. And I suddenly become aware of thinking, how do I address them? I mean, in the case of Ken, it was always Black Joe behind his back or Mr. Kenwood to his face. So during the evening, and we got on, and it got to the point where you got to talk to each other. I said to Ken, I said, "Excuse me, Mr. Kenwood," I said, "now, how do we go on now we're civvies?" He said, "How do you mean?" I said, "Well, what do I call you?" He said, "Call me Ken. I like that." So I said, "Oh, that's all right. I'll just call you Ken." He said, "Yes." So that sorted that out, and that was all right, you see. But it was many years later that I became familiar with George Jelly through my hobby of fishing. And George, it appears, was a fisherman all his life, and at one of the dinners we got in talking conversation, and he was always a man keen to learn. And I've been what you call a match fisherman most of my life, so my knowledge was far in front of George's, and he always was latch himself onto someone if he thought he could learn something from them. And of course we became associated that way. But getting back to the forces, so I sat there in between two RSMs wondering, what the hell can I talk about? Because I sort of felt very inferior sitting between two regimental sergeant majors. But it all sorted out, you know. But anyway, we went down to Ogbourne St George, and for the first time, Ken had got a proper barrack room square. And he was wise enough to say that, because in the army you're not allowed to walk across the square, you must walk round it, you must never walk across. And so Ken, realising this was a bit of a nuisance in wartime, because people were flying about all over the place, he decreed that unless the square was being used, or someone being drilled or squat on there, if the square was not being used, you could legitimately walk across it. And he also decreed that other than majors, the colonel and the majors, you would only salute an officer once. You would not salute him again for the rest of the day. I realised afterwards he wasn't thinking so much of you, he was thinking of the poor officer whose arm would be going up and down like a yo-yo with hundreds of men in a camp. His arm would be flashing up and down all the time, so it was more for the benefit of the officers. And Ken was a proper human being, really, because although he was strict, I would say, he was very good. And he used to walk around, and he always had this 4 feet ash cane which he carried, which was a tradition of the tank regiment. And for those who are not who are listening, who are not knowledgeable, in the First War, at one of the battles where the tanks were, the grain wasn't very good, and so the tank commanders, usually officers, on this occasion decided that the ground was a bit boggy for tanks, and that it meant someone had to walk in front and test the ground. And the understanding in the tank regiment is that there was this copse of ash trees, and these young officers went and were going to match it and cut branches off, which they trimmed, walked in front of the tank, probing the ground with these sticks to test the ground to see if it was suitable for the tank to carry on across it, you see. Well, after the battle, I mean, people are always looking for things to associate with an incident, a battle or a regiment or something. And so in the Royal Tank Regiment now, the warrant officers on proper parades have to carry a 4 foot ash stick in recognition of this particular incident that happened during the First World War, you see. And so Ken always carried his 4 foot ash stick, and as I say, he looked rather comical, which you took good care not to let him know. And so he, rather than the pay stick, he always carried his 4 foot ash stick. And anyway, he used to have these meetings, and I went on one as a troop corporal. I was on one of the corporal's meetings, and he always used to have a little nip before he went to the meeting, so he was never drunk, but he was all sort of in a convivial mood. And this corporal, our senior corporal, a chap named Smith, another old terrier, and Ken would be there, and he'd be giving us his instructions and giving us this lecture, you see. And what was decided to be an appropriate point in the lecture, it was usually left to Corporal Smith. And he would say, "Ah, similarly to that incident in India, would you say, sir?" And immediately Ken would say, "Ah, India, no, yes, no." And away we'd go, and then instead of having a lecture, he would have about an hour's talk of Ken's exploits in India. And one of his incidents he used to relate to us concerned when there was an armoured cars in India. And of course they got these natives who used to take pot shots at them, and used to have a little bit of trouble, and they'd have to send a troop of cars up into the hills to show strength, sort of thing. And Ken said they was up on one occasion, he got this young officer, and of course he said, for those who don't know, he said, some of the old ones knew, because we used to have armoured cars in the yeomanry prior to the war, you see, these Rolls Royce armoured cars. But they don't have a traversing turret. You traversed it by hand, you see. You released the thing, you moved it round, the handle's inside, and you just moved it round. Well, as you can imagine, you get a turret that probably weighs, in this case, not very heavy, so they'd probably be about 2 ton. But to move it to left or right took a bit of pushing. And if you were on a bit of a slope, it obviously wasn't going to turn it uphill very easily. So apparently what they used to do on the slope was swing it down the downside and get a bit of speed up and swing it right around and hope to stop it in more or less the direction they wanted, you see. And the machine guns being on a ball mounting, as long as you were reasonably situated for sight, you could move the gun. And if you were sort of firing at a target about 300 yards away on a ball mounting, if it only moved the gun 2 inches to the left or right, at about 300 yards, the spray would be several hundred yards left or right, you see. So it was sufficient to get it generally in the direction. And Ken was telling us that they were in this situation on the side of a hill and they couldn't get the turrets round. He said, and the young officer called out, he said, because we didn't have Wallaces, he said, we used to have flags and things like that. And he said, this young officer called out, he said, Ken was a sergeant at the time. Sergeant Kenwood, he said, if you could just get out, he said, and get up there. Ken said, I thought, bugger that. So he said, I shouted back, I've gone deaf, sir. He said, I'm sorry, I can't hear a word you're saying. But if you think that's necessary, you bloody well go, he said. He said, there was no way I was going to get killed up there, he said. But the old Ken, he used to tell us those funny stories about India and that, you see. But anyway, we were in this camp, and in the army, in peacetime, you get all this painting and polishing and all this bull, as they call it, you say, all this bullshit, like, you know. Well, I don't think the guards ever, in peacetime, did as much bull as what we did in wartime, in the yeomanry. And we did it that much that in the brigade, we became nicknamed as Prior Palmer's Circus. Because the tanks always look so pretty, they look like caravans, circus caravans. And to illustrate this point, that on the wheels, see, when we first went down there, we still got Valentine tanks. And if you look at the wheels of a Valentine tank, if ever you're at the museum, you notice the hubcap has about a dozen or so little nuts holding it on, of one size. And then the wheel is in two parts, so it's bolted together, the two parts, with a larger nut of probably about a dozen, and they are a different size to the hubcap nuts. And then the tyre, the rubber tyre on the tank wheel, is held on by a ring of little nuts all the way round, which you have to remove, like an ordinary car, like a hubcap on a car. You remove that to get the tyre off, you see. So you've got a wheel with three different size nuts in three circles. And Prior Palmer had this idea, which looked silly outwardly, but inwardly it had a practical purpose, although it didn't do much for your image when it was seen working outside, you see. And he had this idea of everything would be painted red, white and blue. The idea being that when you dismantle an engine, and one area would be painted white, one area would be painted blue, and another area would be painted red. So when you dismantle an engine and you've got a tin, and you're chucking all the nuts and bolts and washers in this tin, when it comes to reassembling, you just simply say, I want all the blue nuts for this bit, or the red nuts for this bit. And it helped reassembling a vehicle's engine, you see, or any other part of the vehicle. But on the nuts on the wheels, they painted one ring of nuts white, one ring red, and the other blue. Well, when they go in, it doesn't look like separate nuts, it looks like a circle, and it looked like an RAF roundel on the wheels as they're going along, you see, which was one incident of the bull that was totally unnecessary, but it looked pretty. And on the bosses of the guns, on the side of the turret where the bosses were, collar dogs are little silver horses. And so we used to have little, and their colours is dark blue and light blue, regimental colours for both the regiments. So the bosses used to be painted dark blue and light blue with a little silver horse transfer on it, you see. Totally unnecessary, but it looked nice. And when we used to have the muzzle covers on the guns, which we usually did travelling about, you see, they were all pulled and tight, and a piece of cardboard inserted in the end so it was flat and firm. And so again, we could have the dark blue and light blue and the silver horse transfer on the boss at the front. Now, I mean, this is right in peacetime, but this was wartime. We're training to kill somebody. And so all this went on, you see. And when we used to wash the tanks down, and it was usually with some petrol, you see, instead of just washing it down with petrol and that sort of thing, we always put some oil in the petrol. And you'll find that if you wash anything down with petrol, instead of it drying off dry and leaving a sort of a very faint white powder deposit, you put a spot of oil in and it doesn't. It retains the colour of the thing you're cleaning, and it also leaves a shine. So it looks pretty, you see. So all our tanks, when they used to go along the road, got all these red, white and blue wheels, all these silver horses on the things, and all the different signs that we had on, like triangles, squares, circles, denoting the squadrons, with the number of the troop in the centre, they were always religiously kept painted spot on, you know. They didn't, were never allowed to get worn. They were always, so air tanks, when they went along the road in training, just running about, not on an exercise, they had let them get a rack and ruin them, but in normal ways, it was always expected to look right. So we became known as Prior Palmer Circus in the brigade, which we looked on with pride, actually. I mean, people saying, they thought they were insulting us. We were doing it, we thought it was good, you know, and we were different to them. I mean, whereas the first line and the glossers used to dub in their boots, we didn't. We still balled up the toes and heels, you know, and everything. So it was rather funny that we had this reputation of Prior Palmer Circus, and we enjoyed it, actually. And I always remember when we left the camp and we went up to Yorkshire from there. Through the winter, we had these coal stores, and they were like a big concrete area with walls, part walls, to so you could put the coal in one, some different items in a different section, you see, with these small walls in between. Well, when we were going to leave,
this is leaving Wiltshire.
When we'd leaving Wiltshire to go to Yorkshire, of course it was in the spring, you see, coming the better weather, and coming out of the winter, and the coal stocks that were left, what we had to do, we had a working party to do this, mind you. I went down and got all the remnants of the coal that were in these different bunkers and put them all into one bunker, you see. And then these other bunkers that had become empty were all swilled and scrubbed and with yard brushes and everything. But the coal that was left, they either found enough or they made some by breaking some down, made a wall of coal along the front, and then the other coal, the bits and pieces and the dust and all that, was thrown over the back. And this is black coal we're talking about, and along the front, and then it was whitewashed so that it looked nice before we left. And our guard room, well, the story is that one day one man from the service corps came in with a lorry, and he was so amazed at the sight of our guard room that he forgot to straighten his lorry. It went straight across the lawn. And because of the bull that was there, the chains, the little low chains that were along the edge of the lawn, were all aluminium painted, and the curbstones were black and white so that they couldn't see, you know, they could see them and things like that. And yeah, all these things. We were certainly a balled up lot, you know. But we lived with it, and we sort of, it sort of became part of our way of life. But again, when we used to get these lads come from the training regiments, because as the war went on, us hundreds, there was about 700 original territorials, as the war went on, with people going sick or whatever, but mostly drafts out to other parts of the world, mainly to the desert, were replaced by young chaps from the training regiments, you see. So as the war went on, us original terriers became thinner on the ground as it progressed, you see. And in actual fact, my squadron photograph of the squadron that went to Normandy, there's only 20 of us original terriers left in the squadron. The rest are all intakes, as we used to refer to them. But even with all this bull and that, you know, and what looked, I suppose, strict discipline, when these lads used to come from the training regiments, they always used to say the same, because when they left the training regiment, where being trained from civilians in about 10 weeks, they found that discipline was very strict. You've got these NCOs who sort of felt their power, you know, and like you see them imaged on the television and films, apparently in a training regiment, it's fairly true to life that you give a normal human being three stripes and he becomes a demon, like you see, because he's a sergeant. All he's got to do is terrorise everybody he lays hands on. And apparently in these training regiments, it was very much like that, because these lads used to come to us, and I say lads because they were usually 18 and 19 years old, although there were some exceptions, older men who'd been deferred or something. But in the main, they were 18 and 19 year olds. And almost the first thing they used to say, God, isn't it cushy? That the discipline, although it was there, was quite moderate compared to a training regiment. They didn't get chased about like they did in the training regiment and all that sort of thing. Although you had to lay your things out on your bed, as you were, you had a photo. They used to lay a bed out and then take a photograph, you see, and that was pinned up, and that was how you laid your bed out. And it didn't matter how you behaved at a previous regiment, that went out the window, and you did what we did, you see. So in the winter, when you had four blankets, it would be three blankets folded as per pattern with one blanket round, you see, top coat folded, six buttons showing, and boots, spare pair of boots showing with the soles to the front, bottoms not nicely blacked and the studs polished, you see, and all that sort of thing. Spare laces rolled up like Catherine wheels in front of the boots. All this sort of stuff. I mean, there was a war on, and yet we did all this. And it became so part of your nature that you never sort of took notice of it, really. You just did it. But even so, these lads used to come in the training regiments, and they used to say, God, ain't it cushy? Because they didn't get chased with the NCOs like they did. Because you're in a wartime situation, you've got tanks laying about all over the place, which you're using. I mean, they're not there to be looked at, and only used now and again. They're there all the time, and that's your job. And the lorry people have got their lorries, and there was always this relaxed thing because everybody's working. You're not doing drill or things like that. I mean, we did a certain amount of foot drill, but it was so mediocre, like, you know. And in that case, we had a very amusing incident when we was at Oakbourne St George, because in the morning, somebody decided that before breakfast, the troops would do a little bit of foot drill, you see. And we had this perimeter road that ran round our area, separately to the other three regiments, you see. What we call a perimeter road. And this main road, when you came in the gate, ran straight up to the squadron office. Straight as a dog, straight up to the squadron office, you see. And our troop sergeant, old Jack Mann, he said to me, you take the troop tomorrow. He said, he never called me Reggie. Very strict old Jack was in discipline. He was all right. And he was an old terrier, you see. And there was no way you could call him Jack. I mean, with a lot of the other sergeants, in normal conversation, not in front of other troops and things, you could refer to them by the name, you see, because we were all old terriers in the main sort of thing. But there was all this sort of element of familiarity, but not with Jack, it was all Sergeant Mann. And he was an old terrier from Kettering. And so this particular one, he said, well, Corbyn, he said, you can take the lads up tomorrow, he said, on the road. So I said, yeah, right, Sergeant. So in the morning, before breakfast, toddy the yacht up, goes up on the road, got this squad there, and we just had some new intakes, you see. And you always get a comic. There's always a comedian amongst them who wants to sort of play about. And they're marching down the road, and I never had a great voice for shouting, you see, somehow or other. I never seemed to be able to get it out. And so, appreciating this, I used to limit the distance I could march them before about turning them, because on a road there is very little manoeuvre you can do for drill, you see. I mean, if you say right turn, and you got three paces, and they got a right turn again or left turn again, as they're walking over the path, you see. So generally we used to use the saluting to the front, which meant when you gave the command salute to the front, they immediately stopped, up 2-3, down 2-3, around 2-3, march back, you see. So that will always turn them round without having to say about turn. So you salute to the front. So they stop, salute, turn round, come back. And this particular morning, I'm standing there and I'm shouting, and nothing happened. I kept on marching, you see. And by now I'd already begun to assess the character of the new chaps, and I guessed what was happening, you see. So I put a little bit more effort into my boss, as I thought, and nothing happened. Well, the Sergeant Major, Tom Gillingham, our Sergeant Major, who came from the North Lancers,